Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It is the 16th of June, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. And as Ray just said in his newscast, an absolutely gorgeous day, so we'll make the best of it. We'll start off with those rays of sunshine coming down, basking in the glory of all of that. And then we'll talk about the news of the day and screw everything up. That's our plan. Good morning. Let's go to it. We begin with an invitation for you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what's on your mind this morning. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, sir. I am fine. Everything is going well, I hope, and it's all nice.
Our job.
Very nice.
Our job is not to change that, is to leave you in as good a mood as you are now.
Without question.
Yeah, that's our mission. We want everyone to feel that way. You come in, you feel good, you leave, you feel better. That's our mission this morning.
I don't know.
Well, and with that attitude, we welcome Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Ever the curmudgeon. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Don't get cranky on us.
I'm not cranky. I can't remember too many times when I've left feeling a lot better than it.
Well, we talk about heavy stuff. There's certainly no question about it. It's not always a little skip in your step news stories. That's for sure. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo joins us from the confines of her home. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm also fine, not in such a cheery mood. Let's talk about bombing in the Middle East.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get to that in a few minutes, I promise, and nice to have you here. Bob Griffin joins us in studio. We're thrilled. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. I'm a little disturbed that I might be the happiest one here. It's usually not my role. You know, Joe, if I could make a suggestion to all of our listeners that they enjoy the day and remember they can take us outside with the app, too. So don't leave us behind when you go outside and enjoy the weather.
No, that's right. Wherever you go, you can bring us with you. I believe that is what we tell people. And it's very easy. So do that. Well, good morning and welcome. Let's get started. I do want to let's start with the Biden and Putin story, and I say that because it's going on as we speak. It is underway in Geneva. What we know is that Putin wants respect. Biden might just give him some. That's the article in the New York Times this morning. By calling the Russian leader a worthy adversary, the president raised expectations in Moscow, but he will expect the favor to be returned. The Russian leader, who will meet his fifth U.S. president since taking power in 1999, has long sought the West's respect. When Mr. Putin sits down with Mr. Biden in Geneva on Wednesday, as he's doing at this hour, he will have a rare opportunity to get it. Putin's goal is to transition to a respectful adversarial relationship from the disrespectful one we have today, a Russian foreign affairs columnist said. That seems to be in line with Biden's objectives for a predictable and stable relationship. And Moscow wounds are still raw from the tumult of the previous administration, when hopes for a thaw in U.S.-Russia relations stemming from President Donald Trump's friendly approach were dashed by mounting sanctions and rising tensions. Now Russian officials hear Mr. Biden's emphasis on predictability and stability and see a renewed opportunity for changing the course of a relationship that is plumbing its post-Cold War depths. I love that term, plumbing its Cold War. I can't say it, but I love it. plumbing its post-Cold War depths. Alan.
Well, it's going on. There's not much more we can say than what everybody has been saying. I am one of those who thinks it's great that that our president made this initiative and is going to be obviously quite plain about what he wants and what he doesn't want. If Putin is willing to go along with that, good. You know, this is a very big country. It's economically very powerful, followed only by China, and Russia's way down the list. But Russia has, as we know, the bombs and all the rest. So it's very important that we get this straight. And that Biden tells what he thinks is right. on the behalf of the American people, and I think he's going to do that.
Yep.
I think he gets a lot of credit, Joe, for bringing this up and making this happen, and good for him.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, I think, Alan, I'm in complete agreement with you. I think it's always good when world leaders talk to each other. It at least creates some bond that hopefully can overcome some of the acrimony. And there's a lot of acrimony. There's a lot of areas of concern that I hope Biden is raising. Before I get into some of those issues, though, I just want to note that, you know, that the chaos of Trump was too much for Putin. He was partially responsible for the election. So I find it a little fascinating that Trump, who was really his guy, was too chaotic for Putin. A couple issues I'll toss to folks for further discussions that I hope Biden raises. You know, obviously cybersecurity is going to be paramount, and that gets into everything from elections to impact on critical infrastructure. But there's some others, too. There's conversations about climate change and what's happening in the Arctic, where there is an awful lot of tension between not only the United States and Russia, but also some of our other partners in Sweden and Finland. There's the issue of what's occurring with China and the pressure that is going to impact both Russia and the United States. And there's also, I think, some significant issues with the nationalization, the national movement in India. So the world is a very it's on shaky ground right now. And the more the leaders have open and honest communication, I think the better we are.
Rosemary.
Okay, so I've been thinking about how old-fashioned this face-to-face meeting business is. The press hypes it. Government spends all this time and effort on it. And what really comes out of it? Frequently, it's nothing more than public relations. We saw this with Trump meeting the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. That was supposed to herald a whole new age. It didn't happen. I think the same is true with Russia. It's really a shame that 60 years after the end of World War II, we still haven't learned to use the forum of the United Nations or something similar to really have meaningful discussions, and not just above leaders who don't have really the power to bring about big decisions, but among the bureaucrats, among the people who really make policy. And that does not seem to be happening. Really, it takes a big meeting and a trip to Austria or Switzerland, I guess they are, in Geneva, to have any meaningful movement in relations between the United States and Russia. I think there's way more hype and expectation going into this than what will result.
I want to go to Chris Churchill. Just a quick reminder that President Biden is expected to have a solo press conference this afternoon, and we've been given a start time around 12:30, so we are going to cover that live as soon as it happens. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Rosemary is right. I think these things are kind of more about the show of it than any real substance. Although sometimes, you know, sometimes real substance does come out of these, and I think there is a real benefit to meeting face to face. And, you know, looking each other in the eye and doing all the old-fashioned stuff that we try to do on Zoom, or we tried to do on Zoom during the pandemic. But, you know, I would just say that if Putin is really serious about wanting, you know, stability and predictability, I think he should probably look in the mirror, because there's probably very few countries in the world that are doing more to destabilize things than the Soviet Union. I mean, you can look at the meddling in our elections, some of the cyber security attacks, the buildup of troops in Ukraine, on the Ukrainian border. I mean, you know.
So do you mean the Soviet Union, which would be a profound statement on your part, or did you mean Russia?
Did I say the Soviet Union? Yeah, I meant you did. Wow, that's no. I meant Russia.
I thought it was a very keen observation, to be perfectly honest. I don't think you made a mistake.
It might have been keen in 1982, but I'm not sure it's keen now.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements, though. I mean, and
I'm sure this isn't the same, but I still call it the Nick Arena. But go ahead.
Yeah, you know, back to Rosemary's point, and I appreciate what you're saying, but there is also a certain while there is theater to these meetings, it also sends a really clear message to folks that are working in both governments. about where the leadership wants to go. And for the rest of the world, I actually think it sends a clear message that there's still hope, that there's mm-hmm. that things aren't so bad, that we're not talking to each other. I get a lot more nervous when we absolutely refuse to talk to each other or unable to talk to each other. So I do think there is the opportunity for personal relationships that can bridge some significant gaps. And I think about the Camp David Accords, and I can think of several other instances where the personal relationships and the fact they met with each other and they took the time out of their lives to do that made a difference. With this said, there are a huge number of issues. Another issue that I'll toss on the table is the use of proxies. A lot of the quote organized crime unquote that is hitting us with some of these ransomware attacks really trace back to the government, and these are issues that Biden's going to have to definitely put his foot down and say what is acceptable and what is not acceptable.
Rosemary?
Well, the Camp David Accords, I was going to say, was not a summit between two world leaders. It was a meeting, a negotiating session in which both sides were brought to the table for actually meaningful talks. And if there was a meeting, say, between Biden, China, and Russia, I would not be as negative as I am now. And as for Putin desiring a stable environment, that's a statement he put out for public consumption, which is in accord with a summit being nothing more than a PR matter. What he wants is a state of the world in which there's advantage for his country. And that's exactly how he acts. That's exactly what he's going to do, why he's going to the summit to achieve that. It has nothing to do with really desiring stability in the world.
I think he's also going to, because it elevates him, right? I mean, when Biden calls him a worthy adversary, that's in a way a sign of respect. And I think there's nothing that Putin and Russia want more than the world's respect and kind of, in some cases, fear.
What does he have to lose, Chris, by meeting with Biden? Nothing.
Nothing. Right?
Yeah. But neither side have. I mean. If nothing comes of it, nothing comes of it. It's the hope that there may be some seeds that will be planted, and there's hope that they could find some areas of commonality, because not every issue needs to be adversarial between Russia and the United States. There's some fundamental issues, I think, facing the globe, whether it's pandemic, whether it's climate change, that collectively we're going to have to work together to try to resolve. Climate change doesn't stop at the Russian border. So I think there are opportunities, even if they're small opportunities. Every opportunity that we have to work together, I think that the world is a better place.
That's a lovely sentiment, but
yeah, Bob, lovely,
Mr. Happy over there.
Lovely, it fits with the day. Lovely and on target and correct.
Okay, well, you may be right. However, the way I see it is that all of the time spent in this gamble for a summit, the preparation, the risk that Biden has taken, because if he comes away empty-handed, he looks foolish, just as Trump did in his quest for a personal diplomatic victory, might have been spent doing other things. I really don't believe that he's going to get any kind of agreement from Biden about, say, climate change, which Putin does not care one whit about the environment. He's going there for progress on matters that Putin does care about and that I don't think he's going to yield on. So, yeah, it's good. You should always talk to your enemies. But to put any kind of great ideology or hope into it is just looking for disappointment, I think.
I'm just a little disappointed that the cuckoo clock didn't go off at the beginning of your statement, because that was really what you're thinking about things that we said.
Is it does anyone on in this group think that it was wrong to refer to him as a worthy adversary?
Maybe. Both words are interesting.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to call him an adversary right off the bat, and you don't have to say that he's worthy right off the bat. It's I don't know. I guess I do have a little bit of a problem with it.
Soul, which some of the past five American presidents who have had these kind of meetings hoping for a breakthrough with Putin have called him. I looked into his eyes, and he has a soul. No, he has no soul. We just have never gotten the full measure.
I mean, it's probably honest, you know, it's probably true. So on that level, I guess it's okay to say.
And, you know, go back and, you know, Biden came out and called him a killer. So, I mean, it's probably better than...
Yeah, he's a worthy adversary for a killer.
You're right.
Killers do tend to be worthy adversaries.
So it's somewhat of a moderated position compared to other things Biden has said.
Oh, by the way, he's also a killer.
And when George Alan, Bush, and Rosemary has a point, when George Bush looked in his eyes and saw that he was, you know, a good guy, right? It was Bush, wasn't it? And said he was a good guy. Turned out he was wrong.
and we knew it at the time too, right? I mean, it wasn't like that was a big surprise that he came around to feeling, oh, gee, this guy isn't what he turned out to be. Let's take a break.
Mission accomplished.
Right, exactly. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We have some letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and we have such letters, so let me read some. Jeff says, as unpopular and visceral as the phrase New World Order may be, our long-term, none of this 5 to 10 year nonsense survival will rely on truly united nations. As it stands now, the UN may as well be the Queen of England. What do you think, Rosemary, since you were the one who made that connection to the UN?
Well, yes, obviously I agree, and I find that really disheartening because there is no replacement. We have new technology that allows for different kinds of communications between and among leaders. None of that happens. They're not using the UN, and they're going back, as I say, to these old forms, which have never been very efficient or effective. So I find it sad and really dangerous for the world.
Sean writes, heard great commentary yesterday that we make a mistake when we focus on the personality of Putin and not the country with diverse views. A little bit of agreement with the notion that the bureaucrats / power levers of government need to be much more engaged than in a single personality focus. Stop with the personal worthy adversary focus on a person. That from Sean.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I think under the Russian system, it really is all about Putin, which is also one of the reasons why I think Trump admired him as much as he did. And I think historically, I think if you look at Russian leadership, that sort of theme runs through even back to the czars. So I think you have to take into consideration the power that Putin has vis-a-vis most of the other leadership in the world. With that said, it's a huge country that is kept together in part with fear and repression by the government.
Let's go to this letter from Ricky. President Biden is complimenting President Putin when he calls him a worthy adversary. As for Putin, killer, not so much. Check. Andre says, good morning. I'm reminded of a debate between the president from President Obama and Mitt Romney when the president mocked Romney for speaking about worry and concern over Russia. Now, all these years later, Biden has to address some worrisome issues with the Russian president. Anyone?
Yeah, I don't remember that. I'll have to go back and look at the. I haven't watched that debate in many, many years.
I remember it well, and I've said repeatedly that Romney was right and Obama was wrong.
Yeah,
Obama had high hopes of switching American attention to the Pacific Rim, to China, and that part of the world, and to reset, as they called it, the relationship with Russia. But he made a mistake of referring to Putin, you will recall, the opposite, as a worthy opponent, and called him a regional power. And that just was the wrong thing to say to a KGB, a proud KGB officer, intent on restoring Russia to Soviet prowess. And it's similar to this, to the comedian's joke about, or no, it was Obama's joke at the correspondence dinner when he said, oh, Trump, is he still here? And that supposedly fired him with ambition to put Obama in his place. Much the same happened with Putin. And so the Olympics and the invasion of Crimea all came after the put downs of the Obama administration. Mitt Romney was absolutely right. So is Obama. There's no question that we have to pay attention to China and the China Sea and the Antarctic and China's worldwide outreach. No question about it. But to do that at the expense of ignoring Russia has been a terrible failing of American foreign policy.
But, Rosemary, isn't that an argument for the fact that the president should meet? I mean, if Putin took that much offense from a comment, then what means that, you know, more positive comments couldn't have beneficial effect? To me, it drives home the fact that it's always good for the leaders to constructively have conversations and build relationships.
Yeah, you know, as I say, I you may be right. I can't argue against it, but I think that is the one mechanism that we keep going back to. It has not been effective. Had this been a meeting, why didn't Biden arrange, a three-way meeting with China and Russia? I'd say, oh, that would be interesting. But this seems to me to be rehashing old ground, going over the same thing. Putin is now on his fifth president. He's getting up there with Queen Elizabeth, who's met, 18 of them. And it just reinforces the idea that we keep talking about at the roundtable, that American foreign policy, well, all of its policies, are very short-term. They're 4 years. And Putin just doesn't think that way. He doesn't care what Biden is going to do, because in possibly two years or a little bit longer, Biden will be out and Putin's still going to be there. That's really powerful.
We go to Stephen, who says, now that we again have a competent administration, the quote-unquote summit with Putin may be largely about the kind of statecraft that happens much more efficiently, if at all, with all parties present. Deals, ultimatums, etc. It's not all about Biden versus Putin. Then, Russ says, the salient characteristic of the Biden-Putin summit is complete lack of balance on the carrot-stick scales. The U.S. has little to offer a petrostate run by criminal syndicates mostly interested in the power growing from the barrels of guns. What can be offered to Russia? Cheaper access for their natural gas pipelines into Europe? Biden would do well to dissuade Putin from injecting further cybersecurity costs into international commerce, but I don't see the incentive.
Well, Biden already gave him that gift, though. I mean, Biden already lifted the sanctions on the pipeline that was one of Putin's major, major goals. That was a major victory handed to Putin right off the bat. You could argue, if you wanted to criticize Biden, that maybe he should have held that back until this meeting so that he did have more of a stick, you know? But you've already given him the carrot.
The other piece here, that, and I don't want to, you know, as a tendency, we want to come across as the good folks, and you know, we also, you know, part of our foreign policy also involves hacking and aggressive offensive cyber. So I mean, it's there's a lot on both sides. I mean, again, I'm certainly, don't send letters in saying that Griffin's taking Putin's side. It's not, but it's just recognizing that there's a complexity of relationships right now. In another area where we're seeing that complexity is space. So there are some areas of that still are so new that understanding and building at least a sense of relationship is important. Also, back to your point, Rosemary, I think it's a good point about, you know, a tri-summit, but sometimes when you bring more parties to the table, it waters down the fact that you're looking to build that specific relationship. And I remember when I led a couple of international delegations where the countries we went to really didn't want to have other countries involved in the conversation with us. So it's a thin line. At some point in time, I really do hope that China, the U.S., and Russia can, and frankly, India could sit down and have a constructive conversation. That might be pie in the sky.
Matt writes to us and says, how can the U.S. take a holier-than-thou attitude towards Russia and insist that Russia change its ways when the U.S. is falling apart at the seams, as witnessed by January 6th? Polarization, divisiveness, gun violence, racial violence, and income disparities. Doesn't Putin essentially view us as hypocrites? Where is the moral high ground for the U.S. to be lecturing other countries on how to behave? Alan.
I don't think he sees us nearly as much as hypocrites as weak. He's a guy. He's a dictator. He has everything going for him. He has no Congress. He has no holds on him. There's nothing holding him back. And, you know, he's a thug, has been a thug, is going to stay a thug, and you have to deal with him as a thug, which leads me to say we really don't know what the United States is saying to Putin. I mean, there's a great deal to be said. This country has a lot of power and uses it. And we don't know what's on the field.
The only caution, and I don't disagree with your use of the word, Alan, thug. The only thing that I'd caution everybody is that thug does not equate fool or stupid. He is smart. Putin is smart as a fox.
There are smart thugs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of times you think about it in popular culture, they're portrayed sort of as moronic. But he's anything but that.
All right, we have this letter from Tina, who writes, the titles of killer and worthy adversary may be insults to Americans, but may not be insults to Russian presidents. Perhaps Russian ways are not American ways? Then we get this.
That's for sure.
We would hope. Bob says, let's assume for argument's sake that Putin succeeds in creating chaos in democracies around the world. Then what? Russia is still a gas station attached to a country, as McCain said. What is his long-term game plan?
Well, my fear is that you'll start to see consolidation back to territories that were formerly in the Soviet Union. And if you're living in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania right now, you are very, very nervous about what could happen with Russians rolling over the border, as should be Poland and Ukraine and others. So I think that the opportunity and fear of continued expansion, when I say expansion, it really is truly bringing them into the country of Russia as a sovereign piece of it. So I think there's an awful lot of concern that folks need to have with that.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, so let us talk about another issue, and that is Israeli airstrikes. Israeli aircraft bomb Gaza just days into the new government, after a day of rising tensions, which saw a far-right march in Jerusalem and incendiary balloons launched from Gaza. Israel's new coalition government ordered airstrikes against Hamas. The Israeli military said it struck military compounds belonging to the Hamas terror organization, which were used as facilities and meeting sites for terror operatives in Hamas and Yunus and Gaza brigades. Palestinian news reports say that one of the strikes caused property damage, but there were no immediate reports of casualties in Gaza, a densely populated urban strip. The day of rising tensions was the first test of a new Israeli coalition government just 3 days into its term. It started when the government permitted a far-right Jewish march to pass through Palestinian areas of Jerusalem on Tuesday night over the objections of Arab and leftist parties in the coalition, and despite threats from Hamas that it would retaliate. All right, Alan.
You know what?
Well, what are you thinking? I can go in any direction you want to go. I can, if you want to.
I don't know what to tell you, except that it's not good. They shouldn't have allowed the march. They knew that full well. They did it, and it led to what we saw. How many times can we get it? This new coalition is going to have a lot of things to work out. And one of them is whether they're in the game with any kind of change, or whether they're the same old thing that Netanyahu did.
Chris?
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, it's just a sign that the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? There may be a new government. Sure. There may be a new government, but, you know, the same conditions, the same tensions, the same animosity is there. And that's, you know, there's not really an easy solution, obviously.
Rosemary?
Okay, so I don't think what happened means very much. You have a brand new government, and it is being tested internally and externally, externally by Hamas, who notably stopped provocations after a day and never sent in ballistic missiles. They sent in balloons, which are bad, but not as bad. They don't kill as many people, and they provoke, but they're not the same as missiles. So there was some restraint there. That's interesting. And then you have the new government, which internally is also being threatened by Netanyahu, who says, you won't be safe under these guys. So they had to respond, and they did, with counterforce. So I think that we are seeing a whole lot of prodding and poking to test each other.
Bob?
Yeah, no, I think, Rosemary, you're correct on that. I'm not at all surprised that they tested the new government. I mean, particularly think how long Netanyahu was in power. Mm-hmm. The incendiary balloons, did cause something like 22 different fires, and I know that in that area the issue of the wildland fires is a problem. I don't disagree with you, though. I think that there is a difference between firing ballistic missiles at Tel Aviv is different than the balloons. With that said, I think that IDF followed the Israeli Defense Forces followed their doctrine that if attacked, they're going to respond with a exponentially greater set of force. Chris, your comment's right. It's the same old, right? I mean, it's the far right in Israel allowing a march that shouldn't have allowed, and it's the leadership of Hamas continuing to poke even after the black eye that they received not long ago.
Well, and as Rosemary has said numerous times, I mean, both sides benefit from this tension, right? It keeps them both sustained.
Yeah.
So that they don't have an incentive to really find any solutions.
It's going to be hard to break that cycle.
All right. Let's go to, we have a few minutes before our top of the hour break. We'll go to the fact that I want to just talk for a moment to see how much time we have to see what kind of story we want to push in here. Let's talk about election. Go ahead.
How about Cuomo? What a story that is this morning.
Yeah, it is.
That they've been raising money, that the Cuomo family and others have been raising money for these two disgraced top assistants to Cuomo, who we were told by Preet Bharara Cuomo was not involved in that, basically, and he has not been indicted. I think this may be the worst challenge to Cuomo's continuance that we have seen, although I still don't see who's going to take him on.
You know, I remember, Alan, as I was reading the story last night, last night, I guess it was when it broke, but I was reading it, and I was thinking of you of saying, you know, of Cuomo constantly distancing himself from Prococo when at his father's funeral was referring to him as his, you know, his adopted brother.
Right.
So now we sort of see that there is a friendship there, obviously. So after one of Governor Cuomo's most trusted aides and closest friends, Joseph Prococo, was convicted of soliciting and accepting more than $300,000 in bribes from executives with business before the state, the governor quickly distanced himself. There would be no tolerance for corruption, he said, calling Mr. Prococo's behavior the opposite of everything he hoped his administration representative. Privately, however, members of the governor's inner circle, including one of his sisters, have for years been quietly raising money for Prococo, according to interviews and newly obtained emails. As recently as last year, the group was helping to fund Mr. Prococo's appeal of his conviction after some of its members also helped finance a trust fund for his children. In one email sent in February 2020, Madeline Cuomo, Mr. Cuomo's sister, sought donations from 24 people. They included Mr. Cuomo's former top political fundraiser, a former chief of staff, several prominent Albany lobbyists, and the head of Northwell Health, the state's largest hospital system, who is a stalwart Cuomo ally. So how much does this stick to Cuomo himself, Alan?
Well, I think this sticks. In other words, at the time, there were an awful lot of people who said, you know, it was hard to believe that Cuomo's two top assistants were doing what they were doing, bragging about it to each other, and that Cuomo knew nothing about it. And not only do I think that Cuomo has something to worry about here, I think our friend Preet Bharara may have also, because he was quite clear that the president, that the governor was not being charged in this time. So I think this is a real tough one for Cuomo. I think the reason that it's not as tough as it could be is I don't see any emergent candidates for the job.
Yeah, and Alan, I like your perspective on this. I mean, and the news is really hidden. I don't think this is going to stick. I don't think this is going to have legs given COVID and the reopening and what's going on with Putin and Biden. If you're gonna have to have bad news, it's actually a pretty good time to put bad news out because it's going to get camouflaged with everything else going on.
Yeah, I was enjoying the fireworks too much to read any of these negative news stories.
So a cynical columnist who maybe in my presence during the break said
that's not me.
As we were talking about Cuomo's speech yesterday about returning to normal and lifting all restrictions, showed that often when these announcements are made, it is on the same day or very much around bad news that is breaking.
Joe, I try to keep my cynicism to the off-air parts of the show.
Yes.
and be the sunny, happy person that everyone expects me to be.
Yeah, like Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
Well, it does seem sometimes that whenever there's a big news story breaking in the New York Times or some other Times Union, some other place, we get a major COVID announcement an attempt to kind of drown out the negativity.
Marching bands, fireworks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's cynical, or maybe that's just the way that
coincidence.
Maybe cynical. I don't see how this is helpful for Cuomo. What am I missing here?
Well, it certainly drowns out the news, if nothing else. Yeah. It has people talking about something else.
Rosemary, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I want to ask one question without being stomped on here, but I don't get how you all see that this is such a major development. Certainly, it's not great news, but the fact that the Cuomo family and Prococo were close is very well known, and they're raising money for a legal defense. That seems pretty kind of routine and to be expected. And I do agree with Alan that my question is on Preet Bharara. If there's something really untoward happening, how come Cuomo escape this? Not that the family's helping out a longtime family associate. I don't get that. I think that deaths in a nursing home and hiding records from the public are far more incendiary than this, but that's just me.
But wait. That's interesting, Rosemary. It really is. But here is Cuomo, who, when all of this was coming down, saying there is no tolerance. Those were his words. No tolerance for this kind of illegal misbehavior. And yet the family, and we all know that family isn't doing anything, although they have said anything without Andrew saying okay. That's a tough one. And I do think this is a very dangerous thing for him because there will be some people who think it's the way in which the Cuomo people were keeping, these guys quiet.
So two questions. One, is it illegal? And two, what does the governor know and when did he know it?
Yeah, well, the first is it certainly isn't illegal for them to raise money for him. And the second is the real question, of course. You're exactly right.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with both Rosemary and Alan. And to kind of take I do think it's significant in
that. Allow that.
Yeah, I think it's. I agree with Alan that it's significant in that Cuomo had made it seem as though he had washed his hands of Prococo and had nothing to do with him at this point, and clearly that wasn't true. But I also agree with Rosemary that compared to some of the other scandals that are out there involving the governor, that this won't really resonate that much. I think people understand sexual harassment. They understand the nursing home thing. They understand a bridge that doesn't, that may not be safe. I think those things resonate much more with people than this kind of inside baseball Prococo stuff.
But you add it to the pile. I mean, there's a cumulative effect, isn't there, Bob?
Yeah, I think so. I think what it does is it continues to cast doubt on Cuomo's capacity to continue to lead the state. Although I'll go back to, I think Alan's comment is at really important. Who's going to take him on?
Right.
You know, I'm not seeing anybody that can take him on. So,
Daisy quickly writes, Kristen Gillibrand is running for governor, my prediction. So that is Daisy's thought on this. A lot of head shaking in the studio. So
I don't think so. I think she's, you know, I really think she's starting to get her legs under her in the Senate, and you know, think about her work that she's doing on the Intelligence Committee. I don't see it.
I don't see that either. I mean, she's got a great job. Why risk it?
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. We welcome your input as well. Panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. I love all my children the same, but I have to say, when I was looking at possible stories last night, I saw this story about the Barbara Starr question, and I became just infatuated with it. It's a fascinating question. I said to Bob before the show, I can't wait to hear Alan, Chris, and Rosemary weigh in on this. And you too, Bob.
Thanks, Joe.
So, regular CNN viewers know Barbara Starr is, who, by the way, just has the greatest name in journalism and in comic bookdom. Barbara Starr is the network's veteran Pentagon reporter, a straight shooting correspondent who delivers periodic news reports on topics like NATO, counterterrorism efforts, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was striking when Starr was revealed last month as one of the journalists whose email and phone records were secretly seized by the Justice Department amid a Trump administration push to discover who was providing classified information to journalists. Striking because Starr isn't like the others. She wasn't involved in reporting or investigating the Trump campaign's ties to Russia in the 2016 election, as were seven journalists from the Washington Post and New York Times and two Democratic congressmen, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both of whom were also the targets of secret Justice Department record seizures. That disconnect has left a mystery. Why did the Justice Department go after Starr, given that she wasn't involved in the Russia story and that her stories don't appear to have been based on leaks of classified material, the crimes prosecutors were ostensibly investigating? The short answer from Starr and her colleagues is a puzzled shrug and a good deal of outrage. Speaking for myself, Starr wrote, I don't know what the government was looking for when it snuck into my life. All right, who wants to begin?
Rosemary.
Rosemary, you're up.
Okay, I agree. I love her name. So she's Brenda's sister. And I don't know if non-journalists know this, but there are stratuses of journalists. And at the top, I think, this is my view, are investigative reporters. She is not one of those. Underneath that are those who have great sources and contacts and get great stories. She is not one of those. She's a straight She gets press releases, and she goes and follows them. She gets officials, like in the Pentagon, to give her stories. She is not what I would call a great reporter. She's competent. So I was kind of jealous to hear that the government was after. There's a certain also kind of star that is attached to you when the government goes after you. It means you're dangerous. You're important. And I also could not figure out why the heck it was her. I actually looked up reports that she had done thinking I had missed something. So if it isn't that, it has to be either her sources or what she covers that the government that Trump was concerned about, and that's the Pentagon. And we know at the end of his term, as soon as he was defeated, he got rid of Esper, the Secretary of Defense, and moved in a whole bunch of really sketchy people to take over the department. So he was really worried about leaks coming from Esper and from the high levels of the Pentagon. And I think that's why he went after Brenda's sister. Either that or they want either that or they just want to annoy CNN. But it was not her work in targeted.
Alan?
You know, Rosemary, I keep meeting people who don't know who Pete Seeger is or was. And when you refer to Brenda Starr, I wonder how many people are out there who remember this very wonderful red-haired reporter in the comic strip.
Is a wonderful comic strip. I mean, it was created in 1940, but I think it's still around, right? Is it? No? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Anyway, it is, I guess it went on. I just looked this up. The end date of Brenda Starr was 2011.
Oh, we're timely.
Yeah. All right. So my, Rosemary, to your point, which I think is interesting, I want Chris to weigh in on this too, but what you said about the levels, the different types of reporters, CNN has this stable of people. What's it? Jamie Gangel is another one, and even Dana Bash to some extent, where they come in the studio, they go to them, they come to this, they're there, and they say, well, according to my sources, and then they just list up. But it's not like they're out. Like Manu Raju, where they're actually reporting, and then will go to a produced piece of journalism that they have produced. It's basically just sort of listing off the facts that they have found, which I think is your point, right? I mean, that's basically. I mean, you said it was just press
correct
releases, but that's pretty much what. I guess that's what it is.
Announcements from the government, big developments about which the government does want certain information out. This is, you know, it's service journalism. I'm not putting it down. It just is not what I ever aspired to do.
Chris,
the thing is that we don't know who she talks to. You know, it's impossible to know why she might have come onto their radar. And I think Rosemary might have hit it on the head when she said that they just wanted to annoy CNN. You know, I mean, we know how Trump felt about CNN. And if he could just add her name to the list to get under their skin, I wouldn't put it past him. But,
and we
although
also
if
know,
they wanted to do that, why not Jim Acosta, who has truly annoyed the White House?
Yeah.
Why didn't they not go after him? She is still kind of a mystery.
Yeah, it is weird. But again, we don't know who she talks to. You know, we don't know her sources. You know, you never do with good reporters, you know. So maybe she's talking to someone that they didn't think she should be talking to. Who knows?
Alan?
Who knows?
And maybe, just maybe, there are a bunch of dunces sitting around in the White House with Trump, and they were just sort of talking about who they didn't like, who we should, and that certainly, knowing that cast of characters, is something that was done. You know, we ascribe to them, well, they think somebody might have talked to somebody else, and they know who it was. They just don't like a lot of people.
Well, certainly it has been well documented, the whims of the president, where he would be sitting in a room and would see something come across the television and would get upset and then go after that particular individual. Bob, your thoughts?
So I'm going to be a crazy conspiracy theorist.
Oh,
right
I
now.
Love when you do that.
you know, my initial reaction was puzzled, but as I thought about it, I'm wondering if they weren't fishing to see who within the Department of Defense she was talking to, especially at that point in time when they were considering the use of military force because of the big lie. So I actually think it's more insidious than what we're letting on to. And I think it goes, you know, I think poking at CNN is a benefit. But I think this had more to do with the concerted effort from Trump in his circle about trying to overturn the election.
Rosemary, your thoughts on that theory?
Yeah, well, that's what I started saying. I think he definitely had suspicions and animosity towards Esper and the people right under him in the department. And she must have had sources among them. I don't know how she could be a top network reporter and not be talking to that level of officials. So, yeah, I think, Bob, you have a good point that he was after Pentagon people, not news people in this case. He's looking for leaks, don't forget.
Yeah.
And he really think that Esper was a suspect.
Yeah, and I think I actually think that they were looking to see who they could, you know, sort of reverse engineer who they could trust if they gave a direction to deploy because of the election. I wouldn't discount that.
Starr said, I am genuinely horrified by what happened. As a CNN journalist, myself and my newsroom clearly were being used as a tool by the Trump Justice Department. Justice Department officials haven't shed any further light on the matter. Starr's colleagues surmise that she may have been a target as a proxy for CNN itself. So, go ahead.
You know, Joe, that's actually a really important point. You and I started to have a little bit of a conversation. I'm getting increasingly frustrated with Merrick Garland, and I think he needs to come out more forcefully about what needs to be done over the Department of Justice. It is fundamentally broken. You look at all of these stories, and I just haven't seen the type of leadership that I had hoped that he would provide the department.
You are so right. You are so right.
So
because
I go ahead. Sorry,
let me just finish that one sentence if I can. I think you're exactly right, and I do think that they're very much aware about the Justice Department. They put in their own guy. He's supposed to be terrific. He was supposed to be a Supreme Court person, but he sounds more defensive about what justice was doing in the old days than he does about being outraged at what they're doing now.
Rosemary? She went away. I think she's maybe on mute. I don't know. I know she wanted to jump in. Yeah. Chris, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to raise the obligatory, I feel like I raise this point every time we would talk about Trump and his attacks on the media, that the Obama administration was horrific in the way that they did many of the same things. They spied on reporters. They prosecuted leakers. They, you know, used the Espionage Act to go after government officials who talked to reporters. So, I mean, this is kind of a continuation, not a new thing. And I don't think we know yet what the Biden administration is going to be like with regard to speaking to the Merrick Garland point.
Well, as you were saying, go ahead, Rosemary. You were muted there for a minute.
What I wanted to say was that I had posted something on Facebook about this earlier this week, my great frustration at Merrick Garland. What the hell is he doing as these revelations come out about Trump's, you know, really invasion of the right to freedom of the press? And then he met Monday with leaders of many of the outstanding news organizations in the country, and he reassured them. He goes, you know, I've been in two months. And I am concerned about this. It is serious. I am going to act on it. And then the guy who actually was responsible in the Department of Justice for these this media campaign that we've been talking about, he quit. He left this week. So I do think that I have to maybe temper my impatience and wait. I think Merrick Garland is going to. He is aware of the level of mistrust and also just the really horrible use of the Department of Justice under Trump. It is completely compromised as far as independence from the White House. And I think he's really aware of that and is building on it. But to ask him to do this in 2 months, he was just confirmed a few months ago, we it's too much. You can't do it all at once.
Yeah, and for the record, I am not stalking Rosemary's Facebook site, but you know, this isn't just Merrick Garland. It's also the slow pace of the transition of Biden bringing his people into these really important political positions. The transition has been too slow. He doesn't have his team around him. With that said, he needs to get up to speed.
Let's not forget that Trump impeded that transition. He did not let people from Biden's administration come into justice. There was no handle.
Alan?
Nevertheless, Biden, when asked about some of the transgressions, had showed more outrage than Garland has. So, I think Garland could have done something more ubiquitous, could have said something like, we want to be clear that this kind of stuff is not right. You don't have to have more than that going on.
I will, just for homework's sake, there is a really good article that was published in The New Yorker yesterday by David Rode about the political, legal, and moral minefield that Donald Trump left for Merrick Garland. Basically, having legal experts say that Garland will have a tougher time restoring public faith in federal law enforcement than any other attorney general since Watergate. You were going to say, Chris. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think I was going to say anything.
Oh, great. You looked like you were just about to jump in there. I'm sorry. So interesting as to where he goes from here and at what point he makes Bob and Rosemary happy. Okay. Let's go to other stories.
But not me.
What would make would that? No, I know.
What would
make you happy? Yeah.
I'll note that Bob promised to be the happy, optimistic one, and then he was the one to introduce a chilling conspiracy theory into the.
Well, you know, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean I'm not being followed there, Chris. I just want to point that out.
Yeah. All right. Quick letter from a listener, Elias, and then we'll go on to other stories. Elias, this is back to the Cuomo affair. Elias is a controller. DiNapoli or Kathy Hochul take on Cuomo. They win easily. Love what Cuomo has accomplished for our state, but it's clearly time for new leadership. Alan, thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a huge fan of the controller, DiNapoli. I think he's the best guy in government right now. I don't know that he has the charisma to do this, to be a sort of political. And, and who was the other one he mentioned besides
DiNapoli? Hochul, Kathy Hochul.
Well, I don't know enough about it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, that would probably be a problem, too, wouldn't it? Yeah, that would be
that same
annoying problem.
I mean, and that might be exactly the kind of person who could topple him, though. I mean, and I do think that if he is going to go down, it will be in a Democratic primary, not in the general election. But, you know, sometimes somebody who is a little bit of a blank slate or isn't charismatic, when people are disgusted with you make the election a referendum on the person people are disgusted with, and that can be a winning strategy.
Rhymes with shiitake.
Exactly. Just look at three-term Pataki.
Exactly.
Yeah. Alan, I think you're right. I think DiNapoli runs a really great organization. He's just a pleasure to work with. And if you need someone to restore your confidence in public service, he's a person that could do it.
And when he came on, it was interesting because, a lot of people said, well, he was appointed, if you remember, to that job by the legislature because we had lost the controller. And it turned out that he was just as good as they got.
It's worth noting, too, that the Cuomo team has already accused DiNapoli of having his eye in the governor's office, and they've kind of tried to discredit some of the work that he's done. Yeah.
To them, I say tough noogies.
All right, so let's go to this story before our bottom of the hour break. President Donald Trump's staff began sending emails to Jeffrey Rosen, the number two official of the Justice Department, asking him to embrace Trump's claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election at least 10 days before Rosen assumed the role of acting attorney general, according to new emails disclosed Tuesday by the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. On the same day, the Electoral College met to certify the election results, which was also the day Trump announced that William Barr would be stepping down as attorney general. The president's assistant sent Rosen an email with a list of complaints concerning the way the election had been carried out in Antrim County, Michigan. The file included a quote-unquote forensic analysis of the Dominion voting system's machine the county employed, alleging they were, quote, intentionally and purposefully calibrated to create fraudulent results. It also included, quote, talking points that could be used to counter any arguments, quote, against us. It's indicative of what the machines can and did to move votes, the document Trump sent to Rosen reads. We believe it has happened everywhere. The claims were false based on a report compiled by Allied Security Operations Group, a company led by a Republican businessman who pushed baseless allegations that the 2020 election was stolen. The email, one of several previously undisclosed records released by the Oversight Committee, sheds light on the type of pressure that Trump put on the Justice Department to take up his crusade against Joe Biden's 2020 victory. Alan.
It's all an extension of the big lie. You know, when you haven't got facts on your side, when everybody says it isn't so, you just keep on pushing every way you can so that the people who are working for you are under pain of excommunication from your administration do tell the lie. And that's what was happening.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I actually appreciated some of the emails going back and forth within Department of Justice. what concerned me there, a couple points. One is sort of this quid pro quo that a couple hours before you're announced as the acting attorney general, they send this over. And I think the expectation was that he was going to follow through on this. It goes back to the conversation we were just having about Merrick Garland, and there's an awful lot of work that's going to have to be done to create firewalls, and I think that those firewalls are incredibly important between the White House and the Department of Justice. It also, I mean, how much crazier and desperate do the Trump supporters need to show the rest of us before we just realize how crazy the whole group is?
Well, I don't know what further evidence we need, but Rosemary, your thoughts?
To me, one of the most interesting figures of the Trump administration was William Barr. Why would a well-respected man with lots of credentials already in government become a henchman for Trump? And then why did he suddenly leave? And it seems increasingly obvious that he left or was pushed out or a little of both because he was unwilling to go along with the idea that the election was a fraud, which is, the same thing that Pence did. The biggest sycophant in the world finally pulled his face out of Trump's rear end when it came to telling the big lie. He wouldn't do it. So I think that's a story that has not been told yet, is how Trump pushed even these two most loyal of his followings into saying, no, we've had enough. Rosen and Meadows and the guys who came out at the end all were doing their bidding. Like, they truly believed it. I think McConnell went along with it because he had his own purposes. But the other guys, man, did they really believe this? Does Juliana and Powell, do they really believe that there was fraud big enough and serious enough to have affected the election, or were they doing it for another motive? And what was that motive? What is Trump's power over people? I find it all fascinating. There's really nothing new in this story. We knew all of this was going on, but it is now confirmed, and motivation continues to be of interest to me.
Chris, 2 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Rosemary that there's, it's not surprising at all that Trump did this pressure campaign. It would be more surprising if he hadn't, to me. What that's kind of piqued my interest a little bit is that the whole thing was focused on this, on Antrim County, which is just this very small, very rural county in Michigan. It's odd to me that if you believe that there is this massive conspiracy to overturn an election, that small county, where there was some clerical mistakes that led to the vote count being a little bit off.
But he said even in that statement, it happened here and everywhere else.
Right. But to think that would be the center point, the center, the focus of their effort is very odd to me. And it also shows just how kind of desperate they were. There was, any little bit of evidence they could find anywhere they would use to kind of make it about a broader conspiracy.
And to Alan's point, Alan, I think it's interesting of what you said about that, it's all part of the big lie, that architecture of that lie and how it was, sort of, I can't say it was necessarily planned, but the way it sort of was thrown together is rather fascinating, especially considering it's still being perpetuated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just hope that people in the Trump organization who may come under indictment will remember his lack of loyalty to other people that have worked for him.
Well, okay, well, I don't know about that. But all right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll have our last go-around. Just a quick reminder that the president is meeting with Vladimir Putin. The second round of Biden-Putin talks is now underway. The president of the United States is expected to address the media around 12:30-ish is what we're being told. So it could be 4 hours before or after that. And we will go to it as soon as it happens, somewhere around 12:30, we believe. In the meantime, we'll come back with our panel for our last go-around. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. It is the last call. We only have about 15 minutes left, so we will do our best to get everything that we have left in that time period. But we welcome you to join us, panel@wamc.org. So let us talk about this story. And that is, well, it's two, really, two COVID stories going together. And one obviously is sobering, and the other one is gives you some hope, I think. But New York, U.S. hit 600,000 virus deaths despite progress from vaccines. The daily deaths have dropped considerably since their January peak, with about 44% of the population now fully vaccinated. Meanwhile, in New York and California, they refer to it as a momentous day, as most restrictions have been lifted. They made the move after more than 70% of adults in both states had received a first dose of the coronavirus vaccine. If you will remember, New York and California were the states hit earliest and hardest by the pandemic. They both announced triumphantly yesterday that they had lifted virtually all of the restrictions on businesses and social gatherings as both states hit milestones in vaccinating their residents. This is a momentous day, and we deserve it because it has been a long, long road, Mr. Cuomo said at the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan on Tuesday, adding that the changes meant a return to life as we know it. In California, where 72% of adults have received at least one dose of the vaccine, Governor Gavin Newsom called Tuesday reopening day as he lifted similar capacity limits on businesses and social distancing requirements with just a few exemptions to that. Alan.
Well, as I said earlier, pardon me, this morning, you know, the idea that if a plane goes down and 360 people die, you'll hear about it for weeks. And there's no question that relative to what was going on, this is much better. But there's still people dying, and there are still people taking chances, and there are still people who are not wearing masks and or when they need to be because they're not vaccinated. And there are still people who refuse, which makes me nuts, to be vaccinated and put everybody else at risk. So that while I think we ought to be saying this is good news, it is good news relative to where we were, I think it's also problematic because we don't want to say ho-hum, there are just 360 people dying.
You don't want to say ho-hum, and you certainly, and I think that's one thing that was just felt a little weird about having marching bands and fireworks last night, that yeah, it's good news, but by the same token, a lot of people died. And Bob, I don't know how you feel about this. I mean, I know you have been fairly conservative on all of this with great concern as we've moved through reopening, of how you feel when virtually there's nothing left of restrictions to protect people.
Yeah, I mean, a couple points. One,
I mean, besides vaccination.
Yeah, we can't treat today as if it's like, you know, victory in World War II, where the war was definitely over. Mm. I mean, I think the point is really well made, Alan. You know, you start to think about the Delta variants. You also start to think about these large pockets in this country that are not vaccinated, and that is a concern. With that said, there is. I think that both California and New York are being realistic about what, you know, about people's capacity to continue in sort of the lockdown COVID mode, and they got ahead of where people were going to be. July 4th was going to be I think crazy anyway because everything is reopened, and I think they were just getting ahead of that curve.
I think your analogy to a world war is actually pretty good because, I mean, one of the things we shouldn't forget is that, you know, much of the world is still completely embroiled in this. I mean, you look at South America or India, even Europe. I mean, Boris Johnson announced a few days ago that they were pushing back their reopening, right, because of all the variants coming in, because they hadn't vaccinated enough people. So, yeah, the news is improving here for sure, but, you know, much of the world is really in bad shape still.
And also, I mean, yes, so 70%, but that 70% is an average. It's not, it doesn't look at, there are parts of this state, of the state of New York, as well as other states, although both Massachusetts and Vermont are doing extremely well in most counties and in most towns across those Commonwealth and states. However, when you look at New York, there are places in some towns and counties where it's 34.
Right, and 40%. Also, and even 70% is a little bit of a meaningless number because it's just your first dose.
Your first dose.
Right, which doesn't mean anything. It doesn't give you any or very little benefit. So it's, you know, it's. Listen, I'm happy that we're open. I'm happy. I like when I turn on, you know, baseball games and the place is full of people. These are all like nice. It's nice to think that life is returning to normal. But I think I kind of agree with you that the celebratory tone might have been a little off.
And the two stories, Rosemary, I mean, one that obviously comes out of this is earlier this week. The I think it was Johns Hopkins, but both the Times and Post were reporting that the numbers of cases is actually going up, especially among those who are not vaccinated. And that's still a large number. And then, oh, by the way, we don't know how long these vaccinations are going to last, especially when you're only looking in many cases, just one out of the two. Your thoughts?
Well, I've never been a sunshiny person, as you know. However, I am not celebrating, and I am not taking off my... I think the whole picture has been and continues to be... There's no one really to blame for this. This is unprecedented. But there's a clear evidence that the world is still under a big threat. Haiti is exploding with cases, for example, and that's just off the coast of the United States. We have not done that. And even in our own country, even in a blue state like New York, only 70% of the people have at least one shot. Yeah. That's not a great record. And as you say, what's going to happen when it turns out you need a booster next year? Are people going to go back? I don't trust people's motives for opening things up and wanting to celebrate. DeSantis did this in Florida, when it clearly, to everybody's mind, was unsafe. But he opened it up and said, yeah, we have to get back to normal. And now he's a possible contender for a vice president. So I don't think that public health concerns were issued. And then for the sake of public health, I think they were issued for other reasons, mostly economic. And that capitalism does not care if people die for the sake of powering the economy. So that makes me nervous. And then also is the poor performance, especially under Trump, but continuing under Biden, of public administrators who should be telling us the straight truth. That they don't know it. I understand that. I know the limitations of science. But they're so quickly changing from one thing to another. No mask. It wasn't in the lab. It may be in the lab. We don't really know. All these things keep changing so quickly that I don't trust any public announcements right now. And on top of all that is a concern that there will be either new variants of the disease, which will be horrible to treat, more unprepared for, or a completely new pandemic, which is possible at any time, and we don't have the mechanism in place to combat it.
You know, the other thing that I noticed, and maybe I think right before we went into this segment, Bob said to me, "Would you say bubbles and unicorns?"
Yes, I wanted the bubbles and unicorn story because it's such a beautiful day. I was trying to be optimistic, everybody. I'm sorry that we sort of be prying you down.
But you know, when you look, so if you're looking for bad news, and I'm not saying I am, and I'm not saying we should, but if you're looking for bad news, even when you have numbers like in Allen's state of Massachusetts, where the share of it's 68% have gotten one shot, 58% have gotten both shots, but also the change in from this week to last week, it's down 37%, the number of people who are going to get vaccinated. So that to me is a concern as well, because as we start to celebrate and as we start to you know, see that all restrictions have been raised, is there still the motivation to go out and for people to get the vaccination? The originally the line was, well, you can partake in all of this really cool stuff if you get vaccinated, and now all the cool stuff is back and we don't have those restrictions anymore.
I think the minute that they said that they're opening, I'm talking about both California and New York, you've pretty much taken away that impetus to try to continue to get to people to get their shots. I think it's going to be increasingly more difficult in order to get to those reluctant populations. And certainly, I think getting people back for their second shots is going to be more difficult. So in that respect, I do think I think we're going to it's still not over.
And we still don't have vaccinations for kids who are under 12 years old.
Yeah.
Which is I don't know.
And as Rosemary points, there's so much science that we still don't know. And it's going to take time. This stuff that doesn't happen overnight to understand, you know, how good the vaccines are, how long it lasts, you know, it, you know, what type of boosters, if any, do we need? Does this just become sort of just a normal flu that we're willing to accept a higher level of death rates? A lot of these questions. Same thing. There's an autopsy that needs to be done on the pandemic because this won't be the last one, and we need to be better prepared as a society.
And there are still states in this country, and not to pick on Alabama, but Alabama is a state that has 37.
Why not?
Well,
I'm good on picking on Alabama.
Okay, all right, fine. Yeah. excellent. Okay, fine. Excellent. All right, let's go. 37% of the state population has gotten a shot. So,
and nobody will tell you that that isn't a political statement,
of course,
on the part of the
right.
people in Alabama. You know that.
And I think that number is actually masked, Joe, because there's a large.
No, we don't believe in those either.
Number of federal employees down there that are required to. So I mean, it's you're right. I think the number is even worse for the general population in Alabama than what's being let on.
And Rosemary, I'm far from picking on you. I just want to pick up on one thing that you said about, you know, we don't even know if we're going to get boosters by next year. Well, I don't know. At the end of, I mean, there were some people initially saying 6 months. So I don't know. I mean, I got my shot in March, as I think most of us probably did around that time, February, March.
Right.
I mean, TikTok.
So when do they go?
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know that. I think the most hopeful thing I've seen in the past couple of weeks was the federal court ruling in Houston that a hospital
yes.
there had the right to demand that its health workers be vaccinated. That's like common sense. Mm-hmm. And wow, it's now issued in a judicial ruling. That's great.
And will it
you
stand?
Remember,
of course, it's going to go up the federal chain, right?
Yeah.
It's going to go up the federal chain, and we'll see whether when it gets the highest court. They agree with that, but you're right, Rosemary, that, you know, it's a disgrace that people don't get what this is all about.
Do you understand, Bob, can you make sense of this, that given this is part of your expertise, as to why health workers especially are so against getting vaccinated?
No. I can't, unless they're, you mean, I mean.
Not all, obviously,
right.
But there is a very high number of people, as we see in the Houston case that Rosemary mentioned, a high number of people that were on the front lines that are not interested in getting vaccinated.
Yeah, the health workers should lead from the front on this. I mean, in my mind, it's equivalent of going to a dentist who you know has bad teeth, and you look at him and go, "Wow, you know, you got to practice what you preach." I also think that it's slightly different.
I had a doctor who used to have one of his three packs a day had a cigarette going while he was giving me an examination. You're saying that was bad?
Yeah, as he's telling you not to eat bacon
right.
sandwiches and drink. It does. So, it makes you sort of shake your head and go, but you know, as far as healthcare workers, it's even more important because you talk about their impact on the rest of us, and they're dealing with the most susceptible for us. So I'm glad about the Houston case. I do not understand anybody who's in the healthcare industry who doesn't get vaccinated.
They can't all be Republicans, can they?
Well, right, yeah. And sort of a mistrust. I think we probably all have our stories, but, you know, anecdotally, I've talked to some of these people who I know and right, Alan, I mean, I wouldn't label them as Republicans, but they seem to be very wary of science and of vaccines. And that's why I asked you the question. Yeah. I don't quite understand the machinations of that.
Yeah, and I wouldn't label it all a Republican or put a partisan spin on it. I mean, if you look at New York, where the lower vaccination rates are, places like the Bronx, I think, are still in the 30s. I mean, those aren't Republican areas. Those are poor areas in many cases, and they're areas where people
have... Take a look at the red states, Chris.
Well, I take it, but a lot of those red states are also very poor places, too. You talk about Alabama, it's one of the poorest states in the country. You know, there are other issues besides politics that are keeping people. There's a suspicion out there, and it's not limited to Republicans alone.
But if you take a look at the red states, you will see a lot more reaction to this than in, you know, the blue states. That's simple.
Right, but I know plenty of Democrats who are vaccine hesitant too. And if you look at, you know, some of the communities where there has been resistance to vaccine even before the pandemic, vaccines before the pandemic, I mean, a lot of those places are very liberal places. I think it's too simplistic to just say this is a red versus blue divide.
You may travel in different circles than I do.
Well, I mean, it bears.
I'm pretty sure of that. Yeah.
You're not out walking at 3 a.m. No, I,
well, he is, but that's a different story.
So my question, but to Alan's point, I mean, we were just talking about this in Alabama. I mean, when you, I get your point about the poor, certainly, and you're absolutely right, and you can talk about the Bronx, good point. But, I mean, it is, you look at the map, and you look at where people are not vaccinated and are, you know, 20-30%, those are red areas.
Right, but you're also blaming the people themselves, and some of those people live in states where the public health network has not been as aggressive at getting the vaccines out to people, right? So it may not, it's not necessarily the case that the person who's not getting vaccinated just, it's the whole system. It's not just the individual choice. And like I said, there are plenty of people who are not Republicans or not Trump supporters who are also resistant to vaccines. I know plenty of them. It's a real thing out there, and it existed before COVID. It's not a new thing.
Tom writes and says, Chris makes a great point, as he usually does. One, does give very little protection to the virus. Announcing the rollback and restrictions in the fashion Cuomo has places people in a situation where they may feel we beat this, but there is much work to do. We'll let Tom have the last word this morning. My thanks to everyone.
No.
Alan, thank you very much. Be well.
Thanks, Mr. Leader.
Rosemary and Chris and Bob, thank you all. We'll be back right after this.